This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. In the 1990 Christmas comedy film Home Alone, a little boy thwarts a couple of bungling burglars by cleverly booby-trapping his home with household items. You remember the tiny toy cars scattered across the wood floor, a prime spot for slipping, and that red-hot doorknob set to singe the hands of the unsuspecting invaders. Yeah, it worked for Macaulay Culkin, but if this isn't quite your idea of holiday home security, how about a 21st century update? In this installment of our App Chat series, we're going to be talking about the latest smart security devices that let you monitor your home from your phone. Joining me now to talk about some of the gadgets that are out there is Roy Christ. He's the associate editor of Smart Home and Appliances at CNET, based in Louisville, Kentucky. He joins us today from WFPL. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk home security, smart home security. What are some of the most popular smart home security systems out there right now?
Well, we've seen a whole bunch of them in the last few years. It's kind of a disruptive part of tech right now, and that word gets thrown around a lot. But home security definitely has been disrupted with these gadgets. They have replaced a lot of the traditional approaches, the call center method, you know, ADT, systems like that, with systems that just put you in that position. They alert you when there's a problem, and they let you make the decision to call the police. Some of the big names right now, we've seen Nest, the popular thermostat that's owned by Google now, get into the game with a new camera. They acquired Dropcam and then replaced it with the Nest Cam, and that's a little wireless camera that you can stick on the wall or put on your desk to keep an eye on things. And there are also some other camera devices that do a little more than that. There's Canary and Piper NV. They're a little bigger. They sit on your table or on your countertop, and they keep a watch on things, but they'll also monitor conditions in your home, things like temperature and listen for noises and, you know, keep an eye on the humidity, things like that.
And so it's a little canister or a device that sits there as your police force, so to your monitoring force, and sends out a Wi-Fi signal to your local internet?
That's right. So it'll connect with your phone over Wi-Fi using your router, and you'll be able to look on the smartphone app to take a look at the camera stream and see what's going on at home. It can be a fun way to keep an eye on your pets while you're at work. And if there's anything going on that shouldn't be going on, if someone's coming in when the system's armed, it'll start recording, and it'll keep a collection of clips and a timeline. You can see what happened and hopefully get a good look at who came in.
Sometimes these systems get fooled a little bit, don't they?
I mean, there can be plenty of false alarms. With any security system, you're going to have a worry of false alarms. You know, if the cat you've got knocks a vase over in the middle of the night, it's probably going to set the alarm off if it's armed. But that's the same with a security system in a lot of cases, a more standard one. So it's nothing too unusual. But certainly there is the risk of the alarm going off when you don't want it to. The good thing is with a lot of these kits, they most of the time won't alert the police automatically like a system like ADT or another larger system will. They'll alert you first and let you make that decision. So if you look on the app and the alarm goes off at 3 a.m. and you see it's just the cat getting into trouble, you can go and clean it up and not call
right.
the police.
Let's talk about the differences between the different systems, the Canary versus the Piper NV. What are the main differences in them?
Well, the two of those are very similar. They're both camera devices with additional sensors packed inside. It's a single unit, about the size of a coffee can that you can put anywhere you like in your home. And if you have a big home, you might need more than one of them to monitor different spaces. The things that separate them are the other sensors inside. Canary doesn't have any other radios for connecting with other devices, whereas Piper does. Piper has a Z-Wave radio, and why that's good is that it can connect it with a Z-Wave smart lock or a Z-Wave sensor on your door or window that monitors when it's open and closed. And you can monitor and add all that into your Piper setup so that you've got a more comprehensive system that way. And that's one thing we like about it.
How well did Canary function when you first tested it out?
Canary had a lot going for it. It was a very attractive product when it was crowdfunded. It raised over $2 million and did very well in the early stages of development. It took a little while to get to market, but it arrived, and people were pretty excited for it. The hardware tested very well. The camera is excellent. It's got a very nice night vision camera, so it can see in the dark just fine. and I was impressed with all of that. It had some sensitivity issues, though. It was a little bit oversensitive with motion, and so we tested it out, and the motion sensor at night was pinged about every minute or so. Every time a car would drive by and the light would pass through the room from the headlights, mm-hmm. it would set the system off. It wouldn't raise the alarm. We didn't have it armed, but in the morning we had just tons and tons of alerts, and that's not very helpful if you're trying to keep an eye on things.
Yeah, as you say, they're not 100%. I saw a commercial the other day for an interesting video doorbell.
There are certainly a lot of video doorbells now, yeah.
Yeah, and this one was to keep burglars away, to let them think that you're home when you're not really home.
Yeah, this is kind of a new trend in the DIY smart security market. There are a lot of new gadgets and different types of gadgets that are designed to fool people into thinking you're home when you're not. And the doorbell is one of the obvious ones. We've had a product called Ring that we've tested that it replaces your doorbell altogether. It's got a camera and Wi-Fi to connect with your home network. So if someone rings your doorbell, you'll get a notification on your phone wherever you are. And you can open the app and look at the camera, see who's there, and even talk through the doorbell to kind of use it as an intercom. And if someone's there who you don't know, you can just sort of pretend you're home and say, hi, can I help you? Mm-hmm. And if that's a potential intruder trying to test the water and see if you're maybe on vacation, that can be a good way to fool them into thinking twice.
Yeah. You know, back in the day, and that means 2 weeks ago, we used to leave lights on around the house. So, you know, leave light on upstairs, downstairs, they'll think there are people home. Are we now in the Internet of Things? Well, that'll happen more automatically.
That's true. Yeah, a lot of people like that about smart light bulbs that you can program to turn on at certain times. And you can do a lot of that with a much more simple timer switch that you plug into. But there are some light bulbs that take it a step further. There's a set that I just tested out about a month ago called the Beyond Starter Kit. And it's a set of light bulbs that have batteries housed inside. They look like little yellow mini Twinkies that you stick into the middle of the bulb. And what that does is it lets the bulbs turn on even if there's no power, which is good. You can leave your lights on at night, and they can turn on automatically when you need them. The cool thing, though, is how they turn on automatically. They also have microphones, and they listen for the sound of your alarm system or your doorbell. You'll actually use the app to train them for what that sounds like. And then when they hear those sounds, they can turn on in a way that you program. If you want the downstairs light to turn on, and then a few seconds later, the upstairs light, or vice versa, you can program all of that and create a pretty convincing look that someone's home anytime the doorbell rings.
Can these devices detect you moving around the home and then learn your habits and collect information about you over time and then be more like self-functioning?
Some of these devices try and have something like that. The Canary actually has a function where it's going to learn your patterns a little bit, but we didn't detect that actually worked too well. But there's a growing effort to make these devices learn about you and be able to function in an automatic sense. And there's definitely an emphasis on motion detection and smart security right now. That's a big, big part of it. A lot of people want to be able to monitor when things are moving around in their home. And, most of the devices we see have some way to do that.
You know, a lot of people want to monitor their kids, put some camera in the kid's bedroom, or anything new about that whole area.
Yeah, sure. There's actually a camera called ULO right now that just had a very nice crowdfunding campaign, it's ULO. And that's a funny one because it looks like a little toy cartoon owl, and the camera's hidden in its beak. And its two eyes are cartoonish LCD screens, and the eyeballs actually move around to follow you around the room with motion detection as it's recording. And you can use that to, just keep an eye on your home and all that. The eyes also sort of send you alerts and let you know in a very subtle way how the camera is doing. If the battery's running low, the eyes will become very sleepy looking. It's very fun and cute. And if you're taking a picture with the app, the eyes will blink. And if you're focusing the app, if you're recording something, the eyes will squint. So it's kind of a unique and a little bit endearing. We kind of like that one.
How do you know whether it's better to go with a lot of small sensors spaced around your home or to go with the all-in-one camera and sensor that sits there in the middle of the room?
Right. I think most of it comes down to the size of your home. You know, we really like those all-in-one sensors when they work well. Piper NV is one of our favorite security products, but if I had a big home with a lot of rooms, a couple of different entryways, I don't know that it would be the best approach. It's an expensive device. It costs almost $300, and you'd need more than one of them to cover a large space. With a kit like iSmart Alarm comes to mind or something else where you can stick up motion sensors and door open closed sensors around the house, you can spread those out a little more because it's a lot of little parts that come in one kit. Go ahead.
Is there any sensor yet or any device that if your home is broken into, it makes the burglars fearful to be there, like the Home Alone stuff that is in the movie. Is there a noise or a voice or anything like that yet?
Yeah, most of these devices have some sort of alarm, at least, that can at least make them quite aware that your home or you are aware that they're in there. There's nothing yet that will blowtorch their head or, you know, send a paint can down the staircase at their face. But, you know, maybe in a couple of years, tech will catch up.
I'll bet. Is it possible, because these are Wi-Fi things, for people, anybody, to hack in to your system?
Sure, that's certainly a concern. You know, that's something that we are, you know, kind of watching evolve as security device makers try and find ways to ensure the safety of their systems and, you know, make sure that people feel comfortable trusting them. And we've seen problems in the smart home space. Some devices that have shipped out with a default password that's very obvious or very easy, something like admin or, you know, 1234. And if people don't change that password in the setup process, they've got a device that's very easy for someone else to join up with and take control of. So that's not good if you've got a camera looking inside your home or a security system that you arm and disarm on your phone. So you need to be a little bit smart about it and make sure that you take the steps to put a password on and check to make sure that your system is encrypted. Almost every one of these smart systems is going to offer some form of encryption, but it's not totally clear to consumers all the times what is safe and what might be vulnerable. So that is a problem area.
When you reviewed all of these, was there one thing that was missing from all of them that you say, oh, I wish they had put X in there?
That's a great question. I don't know. You know, there's so much variance. We've got, you know, cameras and light bulbs and sensor kits. You know, I think that I'm waiting to see sort of more of that learning function that we talked about. I want to see systems that really learn to adapt and can do a better job of discerning from real problems from just, you know, the everyday situations that we talked about, the cat knocking the vase over.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're seeing face detection emerge as a really big part of these connected cameras. A lot of them are starting to trend in that direction and find ways to tell who it is that's actually looking at. And, you know, no one has perfected that quite yet on an accessible level for consumers, but that might be coming in 2016.
Yeah. Thank you, Chris. We've run out of time. Rye Christ is associate editor of a smart home and appliances at CNET. Have a happy holiday, Ryan.
All right. Thanks. You too, Ira.
After the break, should climate scientists speak out, and why are some scientists so reluctant to say something? We're going to be right back after this short break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Last week, as negotiators in Paris were toiling over the details of the landmark climate agreement, Senator Ted Cruz held his own climate summit of sorts, hearing about what Cruz called the, quote, ongoing debate over climate science.
Facts matter, science matters, data matters. That's what this hearing is about. According to the satellite data, there has been no significant global warming for the past 18 years. Those are the data. The global warming alarmists don't like these data. They are inconvenient to their narrative.
The global warming alarmist he's referring to are Secretary of State John Kerry, the media, and climate scientists. But my next guest says that many climate scientists, despite often being portrayed as alarmists, are actually underplaying their concerns, erring on the side of less rather than more alarming predictions, erring, as she says, on the side of least drama. Are they then selling the public short by giving only their most conservative predictions? And if they are already seen as alarmists, do they have that much to lose by telling it as they see it? In other words, the popular anti-terrorism slogan, if you see something, say something, asks citizens to speak up if they see a potential threat, does that apply to scientists too? Naomi Oreskes is a co-author of the book Merchants of Doubt, now a documentary film. She's a professor in the history of science and earth and planetary sciences at Harvard. And she gave a talk on this very subject at this week's meeting at the American Geophysical Union in San Francisco. She joins us from San Francisco and KQED. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Do you find scientists afraid to tell what they really know or suspect?
The short answer is yes, although I think the word afraid might not be really fair. Our research has really been focused on trying to answer the question, first of all, have scientists overstated the threat of climate change or not? Because that's an accusation that's often been lodged at them, that they've been exaggerating the threat, that they're alarmists. So we wanted to answer that question on a factual basis. And then the second part was, once we saw what was going on, to try to explain it. And so what we found in our study, by comparing predictions that scientists had made 10, 15, 20 years ago with what had actually happened in the climate system, we were able to answer that question, the first question. And we showed in our work that, in fact, scientists had not exaggerated the threat, that in most cases, scientists had got the predictions right within the error bars, or there was a systematic bias towards understating the threat. So what we showed was that actually scientists were under, if anything, it was they were either correct or they were understating the threat. There was no evidence to support the claim that they were exaggerating. So then the second part was, you know, why would they do that? And I don't think it would be fair to say that they're afraid. I don't think that scientists are cowardly people. But we argue that there were a number of factors that were contributing to this pattern.
I want to push back a little bit on that from my own personal conversations with climate scientists over the years, off the record. They would tell me, you know, I think we've reached a tipping point. There are things that are very, you know, going to have great consequences and we can't go back on. And I would say to them, why don't you say these things? And some of them would say to me, well, I'm afraid of causing a panic in the public.
Well, certainly that's true for some people. And I didn't mean to imply that that was never the case. Certainly the sense that it's important not to overstate the threat lest you cause panic. That's not just climate scientists who feel that way. Seismologists deal with that issue all the time. So I think scientists are mindful of the fact that from a social and public point of view, there can be some risks if people overreact. But at the same time, when it comes to climate change, there can be very profound risks if we underreact, because if we don't clearly explain what's happening and make clear why these changes are potentially so damaging, potentially so frightening, and then people underreact, well, then there's hurt and harm that comes from underreaction if we fail to adequately prepare and adequately respond to the threat.
Our number, 844-724-8255 is our number. Talking with Naomi Oreskes, co-author of The Merchants of Doubt. We, you know, back in the early days of the environmental movement, and late 60s, early 70s, in those days, there were very vocal scientists around. People like Paul Ehrlich, who's still here, Barry Commoner, Carl Sagan, people like that, who spoke out in public forums. Do you think we need to have more scientists speaking out, speaking their minds?
Well, I think yes, but not in that way. I think one of the problems of the 1960s was that there were a few number of very prominent, very charismatic, and very vocal scientists who came to stand in for the whole scientific community, and their personal views and their personal interpretations were sometimes taken as reflecting the views of the whole community and reflecting the peer-reviewed scientific literature. You know, our work was not focused on what a few individuals were saying. We were focused on trying to understand what was published in the peer-reviewed literature and how that science, the actual science, compared to the actual changes that were taking place in the world. So I think it's a bit of a problem for the scientific community if we rely too much on one or two charismatic leaders like Carl Sagan or Steve Schneider or Paul Ehrlich, and that in a sense our message is that the whole scientific community, or maybe not the whole community, some people are not personality suited to speaking up in public, but that, you know, the scientific community as a whole needs to be making an effort to communicate clearly to the public what our scientific results are telling us. So not our own personal opinions about, you know, what we're afraid of, but what is the scientific evidence telling us about what's happening in Greenland, in Antarctica, with sea level rise, with crop failures, with this California drought? That kind of information, the really factual information, not just about what we think is going to happen in the future, but what's actually happening on our planet, on this Earth right now, things that we can see, things that we can measure, things that we have, in fact, seen and measured.
Do you feel this personally yourself about speaking out like you're doing today?
Personally, that it's important to do it. That's why I'm here.
Yeah. I mean, is there a danger, though, for some scientists that they won't be trusted if they speak out too much, if they exaggerate or crying wolf? Are they fearful of that, too?
Yeah, scientists are definitely afraid of that. And of course, it's really important to be clear. We're not saying that anybody should exaggerate. What we're saying is that our work shows is that people have actually understated the threat so that these fears about speaking out, these fears about crying wolf, and you're absolutely right, scientists, we also did interviews with scientists, and many scientists expressed the fear that if they cried wolf, they would lose credibility. So we're not saying anybody should cry wolf or exaggerate the threat. We're saying people should clearly communicate what we know, and what we've demonstrated is that there's a systematic bias in the community the other way, that we're actually understating the threat. So our argument is we should neither understate nor overstate, and we should understand the social pressures that have, in fact, led us to understate the threat up until now.
And do they do this as the means to do this in their papers, when they publish their papers, not to be overly conservative?
Well, that's a very interesting question. And what we've argued in our work is that the first step in that direction is simply to be aware of the problem. Most scientists, until we published this, were not actually aware that this was the case. I mean, there were a few people who had suggested that it might be the case, and that was part of our picking up on the issue. But by and large, most scientists did not know that this was actually occurring. So what we've tried to emphasize and what I talked about here in San Francisco on Monday was to say, if you're aware of this tendency, if you become aware of the bias, then you can look out for it and try to avoid it.
You heard the little cut we played of Ted Cruz and his committee meeting. Were any scientists that you know of a great climate repute in any of those committee hearings that he held?
You know, because I've been here in San Francisco all week and following the COP proceedings, I wasn't really looking closely at what Ted Cruz was doing. But certainly many climate scientists that I know personally have been the subject of the targets of attacks by people, well, by colleagues of Ted Cruz, like Lamar Smith from Texas, Representative Joe Barton. So it's certainly the case that climate scientists have worked in a political climate of hostility and pressure and even intimidation. And so that, of course, is another factor that contributes to scientists wanting to keep their heads down. And we think probably also contributes to the underestimation that there's this tremendous hostile pushback from some members of Mr. Cruz's party.
Mm-hmm. You know, the oil is going way down. The coal industry and stock price is sort of collapsing. If fossil fuel lobbying somehow disappeared, what would lawmakers say, you know, about not doing anything about climate change in this country?
Well, I mean, that's a very important suggestion. I mean, of course, we know that one of the reasons it's been so difficult to get sensible policy action on climate is because of this tremendous pressure and pushback from the fossil fuel industry and their other allies. In my more recent book with Eric Conway, The Collapse of Western Civilization, we wrote a kind of science fiction parable of what could happen if we don't take action. And we talk about what we call the carbon combustion complex. There are a group of industries in this country led by the fossil fuel sector, but also supported by other sectors that rely on inexpensive fossil fuels that have pushed back very aggressively against any kind of sensible regulation. You mentioned the very low price of gas right now. This is really the perfect time to introduce a carbon tax, which virtually all economists agree would be the most sensible, easy, and efficient way to begin to discourage the use of fossil fuels and encourage the use of non-carbon-based fuels. A time when the price of gas is low is the perfect time to bring that in, because it wouldn't hit people too harshly in the pocketbook, and then to ramp that up. And I think one of the most significant news items of the last couple of weeks is not Mr. Cruz spouting nonsense about climate science, but actually the fact that the province of Alberta, the home of the tar sands, they've just announced that they are going to introduce a carbon price of $20 a ton and begin to ramp that up over the coming years. That's a hugely important step in the right direction. It's a model for how it can be done, and it's being done in a province that has a very, very heavy reliance on fossil fuels. So they've managed to negotiate with the fossil fuel industry and get them on board to move in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. In fact, if I remember, I want to get your take on what went on in Paris last week. There were, 120 companies that went there saying, we need, you know, we're behind you. We need to have some sort of regulation here.
Right. And that's terribly important, because it's a recognition that sometimes people want to say that the business community is against sensible regulation on climate. But that's not true. A certain sector of the business community, mainly the fossil fuel sector, has pushed very, very aggressively against any form of sensible regulation. They've also funded disinformation campaigns. They've been involved. They've funded organizations that have attacked scientists. So there's been this incredibly destructive and damaging activity on the part of some parts of the fossil fuel industry. But on the other hand, you have many leading corporations, including Nike and Walmart and Goldman Sachs, who have said, no, we need sensible regulation. We need to move forward. This is in the interest of everyone. It's in the interest of the world. And it's in the interest of the business community to have a clear signal and a level playing field. Because if the regulations are sensible, and if they're transparent, and if they're the same in all 50 states, then we can respond and we can move forward in sensible ways. What we can't do is respond if we don't know what the regulations are going to be, or if they're going to be overturned in lawsuits, or they're going to be fought by, you know, certain sectors. So you have these very courageous business leaders. Paul Polman of Unilever has been really fantastic on this issue, saying the time has come for sensible regulation, and honest businesses realize that this is actually in the interest of the vast majority of people.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking with Naomi Oreskes, co-author of the book Merchants of Doubt. Let's see if we can go to the phones and take a couple of calls before we run out of time. Let's go to Davis in Orleans, Massachusetts.
Yes, hi, Ira. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My question to you and your guest is quite simple. I'm wondering if in the climate change debate, particularly with the presidential debates happening, are climate scientists becoming perceived as liberals?
Well, that's a great question, and I think it's really a tricky one. The anthropologist Ashley Montague once said a long time ago that reality has a well-known liberal bias. Part of the reason this issue has been so difficult for so long is because the reality of climate change tells us that we have a problem in our economic system. And that problem is that our prices, the price we pay for fossil-based fuels, carbon-based fossil fuels, doesn't reflect the external costs, the damage that those fossil fuels do in the world. And so that means that climate change, in many ways, is an economic problem. And it's an economic problem that requires the government to step into the marketplace to do something, such as impose a price on carbon. And that idea that the government needs to play a leading role is very anathema for many conservatives in this country. And so when climate scientists say we have to do something about this climate problem, that's perceived by many people as being a liberal position. And it's put scientists in a very difficult place because they don't want their science to be politicized, because many climate scientists are not actually liberals on other matters. I mean, climate scientists are very diverse and have a very wide range of views, but they've been typecast as being liberals. And then that's part of the reason why it's generated hostility among people like Mr. Cruz.
Is there any way, when you talk about scientists really not being too conservative in reporting their findings, do you have any message for scientists out there about what to do from now on or how to cope with that?
Well, you know, it's very tricky. I mean, I have a couple of messages. The first message falls out immediately from our work, which is simply accuracy, accuracy, accuracy. The job of a scientist is to do the best job that he or she can do in understanding the natural world, to report that as accurately as possibly, and to communicate it as accurately as possible. That's not an easy task, but that is the task of the scientific community. So that's my main message. But my second message now going forward is a little different, and we talked about this on Monday at AGU as well. To some extent, I think the time now has come for scientists to turn over the conversation to economists and political scientists and engineers, because really what the message of COP is, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger said this many years ago here in California, we know the science, we see the threat, and we know the time for action is now. He said that a decade ago, so it's still true today, and that's the message of COP. This is really no longer a scientific question. It's an economic, social, political, and engineering question. And so I think it's very important for scientists to continue to do their work. We have tremendously important work we need to do monitoring what's happening with the ice sheets. But in terms of the solutions and the going forward, I'd really like to see a lot of this conversation now handed over to people who can really move us into that conversation about solutions.
Well, they have picked up the ball, you know. They know where the money is. You know, it's certainly in states that are wind energy states, they're making a lot of money. And the companies that know that there's no more ice in the North Pole in the summertime are talking about profiting from that. So I think your message is beginning to be heard. I think other corporations are picking it up. I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today. And good luck to you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being with you. And I hope you're right.
Naomi Oreskes is co-author of the book Merchants of Doubt, and now a documentary film. And she's a professor in the history of science and earth and planetary sciences at Harvard. We're going to take a break and talk about designer cells that can stop an autoimmune attack before it starts, at least in the laboratory. Let's hope we can get it out of there. We'll tell you more about it when we come back, so stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you've ever suffered from eczema or psoriasis, you know the feeling when an attack's coming on. You can feel the irritation, the swelling, the onslaught your immune system is about to launch against your skin, and there's not much you can do about it at that very moment. But now scientists have designed a type of cellular implant that listens for those first rustlings of an imminent attack, and the cells actually launch their own counterattack of anti-inflammatory compounds. How do they do it? Well, that's what we're going to be talking about. Martin Fussenegger is a senior author on that research, out this week in the journal Science Translational Medicine. He's also a professor of biotechnology and bioengineering at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. That's in Zurich, Switzerland. Welcome to Science Friday.
Yeah, hi, Ira. Good afternoon.
Thank you. Good evening to you.
Thank you.
Tell us how these designer cells work. How do they stop the psoriasis from flaring up?
Well, what we've done is we've taken human cells that were put into culture a long time ago, and we have equipped these cells with genetic circuitry that can sense the primary proteins of the immune system that trigger psoriasis. And these designer cells can not only sense psoriasis and its component, these pro-inflammatory proteins, they can also process that information and tune an appropriate response to stop psoriasis. And they do that by producing specific proteins, which are also cytokines, but this time anti-inflammatory cytokines. They are produced by the designer cells, secreted by them, and delivered back into the bloodstream where they contain and shut down the inflammation.
Mm-hmm. And you've tried this out in mice in the laboratory.
And yes, exactly. We have designed human cells, as I just mentioned. We've packaged them into alginate beads. That's an algae gelatin, a sugar structure, such as to protect the human cells and the human componentry from the mouse immune system.
And it works?
Yes, it works. So if we induce psoriasis in those animals, we do that by just shaving them and applying a specific cream that triggers a massive inflammation of the skin, which is almost identical to a psoriatic flare in humans. And we could show that mice which had been implanted with those designer cells, they did not get a psoriatic flare because the designer cells was early on detecting that the immune system is mounting an inflammatory response and were just shutting it off from the beginning. Mm. So psoriasis could not even develop.
So how do we move this into people?
Well, essentially, we're already rather close because we're using human cells, we're using human componentry, and we're using human anti-inflammatory proteins, those cytokines which have already been tested in human clinical trials. So what we would do next is we need to bring several people together because we cannot carry this forward as scientists at a public research institution. We're engineers. We need to team up with medical doctors at the university hospitals. We also need to have pharma people at the table. And these three different groups will develop that further, with mm-hmm. the first steps being to produce these human designer cells under what we call good manufacturing practice, GMP, which is a standard protocol issued by the authorities, protocols which you need to follow when you would like to go with biological material into patients.
Would this be something you sort of slip under the skin of people with psoriasis?
Yes, exactly. We would package them, not necessarily in this algae gelatin, although this material has been already licensed for clinical trials. We would put that into a plastic bag, which is kind of what we call semi-permeable, which means the the immune system will not attack the cells, yet the psoriatic cytokines can go to the designer cells and the designer cells can react to contain psoriasis. And we would put that under the skin where the designer cells automatically connect to the bloodstream so they can detect the onset of psoriasis and can produce and systemically deliver the anti-inflammatory proteins.
Could this theoretically, this kind of treatment, be used for other inflammatory diseases like arthritis or autoimmune diseases?
Yes, exactly. The principle is kind of generic because we could exchange the sensor capacity of these designer cells instead of just sensing the two cytokines that are so specific for psoriasis. We would exchange them to sensor molecules for other autoimmune diseases. And then, again, the processing capacity could be the same. And in case we need to produce anti-inflammatory proteins, this could all go into the same concept and could also be designed for other autoinflammatory diseases and autoimmune diseases.
This is a long process. You know, when we talk about cures or treatments, people who have the diseases or everybody knows somebody who knows somebody who has something like this, they say, when can I have this? You're talking about years from now, right?
Yes. I think this will certainly take 10 years from now on. And this may be a disappointment for some, but I think it's very important. This is a completely new treatment strategy which has not been tested before, and safety is always first. We don't want to rush this on the market at the risk of harming the patients. We would like to offer a new treatment concept for psoriasis and beyond, and it needs to be carefully tested according to the rules. And I believe we're getting there, but it's not an immediate product that people can expect in the next 2 or 3 years. I think this will take 10 years.
Well, Dr. Fussenegger, we wish you good luck, and we'll hope to follow this along with you. Martin Fussenegger, professor of biotechnology and bioengineering at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. That's in Zurich, Switzerland. Hours after the December 2nd shooting in San Bernardino, the New York Times reported that the top Google search in California with the word Muslims in it was "kill Muslims." Economist and former Google data scientist Seth Stephens-Davidovich calls Google's searches a modern-day confessional box. What can Google searches tell us about public sentiment on controversial views that polls and surveys cannot always measure? Seth Stephens-Davidovich is here in our New York studios. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks so much for having me, Ira.
Why do you call Google searches a modern-day confessional box?
Well, just to clarify, this is research with Evan Soltis as well.
Okay,
and
good.
The idea is that there are sometimes you think of Google, sometimes when you type into Google, we think of it as an information source. So you type in a question you have, what's the weather going to be tomorrow, or who won the game last night, or what's a good recipe for apple pie. But sometimes people type just random thoughts they have into Google. You know, I hate my boss, people are annoying, I am drunk, and these searches tend to feel like confessionals. They're admitting things that they might not want to admit in polite company or might not tell to a survey. So it gives kind of a different perspective and often, unfortunately, a darker perspective of the human psyche.
Is there any predictive value in this?
Yeah, so that's what this research was doing with Evan, is that we were predicting over the last 2004 to 2013, can you see by what people search into Google anonymous aggregate data, can you predict when hate crimes against Muslims will be high? So when people type things like these very disturbing searches like kill Muslims or I hate Muslims, are hate crimes against Muslims higher? And the answer is unambiguously yes. There's a clear relationship. On weeks when these searches are higher, there are going to be more anti-Muslim hate crimes. And what we also say is that this means we predict that anti-Muslim hate crimes are at levels not seen since the aftermath of September 11th right now, because these nasty searches about Muslims have shot up recently.
Were you able to see any trends in where this was all happening, different populations?
We did a little bit of that. We have to look into it more. I think, you know, there's a lot that is obviously another power of the Google search data. If you think of a survey of, let's say, 1,000 or 2,000 people, you're not going to really have detail on different states, let alone cities or towns. But because Google searches are such big, they're big data, they have so many observations, you can really zoom in on very small communities and test a lot of hypotheses about hate.
You would really need to get into a person's head to gauge Islamophobia and hateful sentiment towards Muslims. You tried to tackle this with key phrases, right?
That's exactly right. And I think, you know, one thing to clarify is it doesn't mean, you know, first of all, this is anonymous and aggregate data. We don't know the reason that anybody makes a search. It could be the most horrible search, the most horrific search possible, and someone could just be curious or doing research, or there are plenty of other reasons to make a search. But on average, when these searches are high, we see that hate crimes against Muslims are high as well.
After the attacks in San Bernardino, President Obama gave a speech asking for tolerance, and you used Google searches as sort of a real-time tracking of public opinion.
That's exactly right. So this is another advantage of the Google searches. You really do have it down to the minute. So Evan and I, right after this speech, we had already been working on the article and the research. We were kind of like excited, oh, can we see, you know, has this helped things? Because the speech was very moving. He talked about the importance of, you know, not judging people based on their religion, of taking people into this country regardless of their religion, American values, freedom over fear. And we got very excited, oh, let's see how the searches have responded to these well-meaning words. And we found out, disappointingly and disturbingly, that if anything, it seemed to just provoke the angry mob or provoke intolerance, that searches for kill Muslims shot up threefold, and searches for how to help Syrian refugees dropped 30%. Searches against Syrian refugees, no Syrian refugees, went up 60%. So if anything, it seemed like Obama's speech on average backfired.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Seth Stevens Davidowitz about Google searches. He's an economist here in New York. But there was one interesting thing about the speech. When the president sort of turned a bit and started talking about Muslim American soldiers and Muslim American sports figures, right?
That's exactly
it's like a whole different thing happened.
That's exactly right, Ira. So there was one line where he talked about how Muslim Americans are our friends, our neighbors, our sports heroes. They're the men and women who are willing to die for this country. And after that line, for the first time in a year, the top noun searched with Muslims was not terrorists, extremists, or refugees. It was athletes. People wanted to see, you know, wanted to learn more about these Muslim athletes. And number two, after athletes, was soldiers. People wanted to learn more about the Muslims who have signed up to serve for the nation. And athletes kept the top spot for more than a day afterwards. And, you know, we kind of said on Twitter, there was also a lot of tweets, you know, a lot of fans, people who had grown up rooting for Shaquille O'Neal, the famous basketball player, were now tweeting in a bit of shock, wait, Shaquille O'Neal's Muslim? So that was kind of a little bit different than the more generic statements that Obama was giving that seemed to just inflame people. This was more new information, piquing people's curiosity, and really changing what people thought about Muslim Americans. So that had more positive effects.
It also shows the power of speech, doesn't it? Saying the right things.
Exactly right. But it shows that, and it shows that it's more subtle than we usually think. That, you know, a lot of people, if you say something like, we need to care more about freedom and not give in to fear, and that, you know, we can't judge people based on religion. When you say things like that, afterwards, you're going to get rave reviews from all the, you know, serious people for saying these things. But that actually backfired. But this one, but there are subtle things you can do where you really pique people's curiosity, and you can, with words, change how people think about a group.
What kind of data would you like more of? What's your holy grail that you're looking for?
I think Google searches are pretty good. I don't think, you know, I've actually done a whole bunch of research on this starting about 3 years ago. And I'm writing a book about it that everyone should look out for. And that's coming out in a few months. But it is like a confessional. And people are telling things. I don't think many people are going to tell a poll that right after San Bernardino, they had an urge to kill Muslims. But that is something that people do type into Google. And when you look at it anonymous and aggregate, you really do get a really unprecedented view into the mind.
Is there any way of making this more scientific about what people think and how they act afterwards?
Well, we think our work was pretty scientific, but we are writing it up as a scientific publication,
right.
and there are more details where we kind of flesh out a little more of the models we used and stuff. But we think that this will show, and we have already shown it, and in the paper we'll clarify in more detail that there is clearly a way to tie people's thoughts, kill Muslims, I hate Muslims, to people's actions, anti-Islamic hate crimes.
Mm-hmm. And it's also, this all sounds so much a little bit like Minority Report, where, you know, in the movie they could predict a crime, a killing that was going to happen beforehand.
It raises some difficult questions. We didn't really go there, but it does raise some questions. Mm.
So what's next? Writing the paper? Where would it show up? Where would you publish it?
We're going to send it to a variety of journals. So it'll be on our websites initially, and then Evan's and my websites, and then initially, and then eventually to an academic journal, yeah.
Well, I want to thank you for taking time to be with me. Well, this is a new age, isn't it? Following Google. Can you do anything with Facebook? Any Facebook kind of things the same way Google?
I think Facebook data is a bit overrated because it's public. People don't type to Facebook. You know, usually type that you're in the Caribbean and how much you love your husband and your family's all great and you love life.
Right.
Whereas Google gives a more pure, it's a little more pure because it's not broadcasting to all your friends.
I got it. Thank you very much and good luck. We'll be following this.
Thanks so much.
Have a happy holiday.
You too.
Seth Stephens Davidowitz is working on all this stuff. He's an economist based here in New York. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. And help the Science Friday Book Club pick our next book. This winter, we're celebrating the literary legacy of Oliver Sacks. But the book we read is up to you. So we want you to cast your votes at sciencefriday.com/bookclubvote. And the Force Awakened today in theaters across the country. If you're a do-it-yourself kind of Jedi, you can find tips of making your own Star Wars lightsaber. Yeah, show up with the lightsaber you made over the weekend. And you can get the instructions for that lightsaber at sciencefriday.com/lightsaber. That's S-A-B as in boy, S-A-B-E-R. Hoping the Force is with you this weekend. Merry Christmas and happy holidays. We'll be back with an all-new show next week. We'll be here on Christmas Day with a show that's going to look back on the internet and all kinds of interesting new things. So stay with us. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.